Hello, most excellent humans, and welcome to the Atypical Behavior Analyst, your place and space to hear conversational information about the science of behavior analysis. I am your host, Kelly, and welcome to episode 47. Before we jump into today's discussion, let's go over some quick housekeeping. First off, we're ACE approved, so if you're listening for continuing education units, jot down the two keywords interspersed during the talk and then take those over to our website, atypicalba.com, where you can purchase your CEUs. And then take a few minutes to cruise around the rest of the site to find additional resources for each episode and more information about our fantastic guests. Next, if you'd like to stay up to date with upcoming talks and live events, you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Our live events are a fantastic time to hang out, learn, and interact with our guests, and our social media is a great way to get to know the podcast, so reach out and say hi. You can also rate and provide feedback on your favorite listening platform to help further our dissemination mission. And lastly, stick around after the talk to hear a preview clip from episode 48. And now, today's knowledge. Some of our previous guests have talked about applying the science of behavior analysis to health, fitness, and wellness, creating programs for others or for oneself, building and improving physical fitness, but sometimes our bodies give out and injuries happen. Then what? Can the science of behavior analysis be applied to recovery? Well, Dr. Brennan Armshaw joins us today to discuss how by expanding our perspective on what is behavior analysis, we can begin to change the how of the how is behavior analysis applied. Brennan will discuss the landscape of behavioral medicine with a particular focus on how behavior analysis in combination with technology can be applied to improve physical therapy outcomes and reestablish muscular responses that may otherwise be undetectable. He'll describe how he approached collaboration with physical therapists, surgeons, and patients to improve these physical therapy outcomes for patients recovering from total knee replacement surgery, and the techniques and systems he developed along the way, and the balance of translational and applied research. So check your posture and adjust your note-taking materials and tune in to episode 47, Expanding the Behavior Analytic Universe, Behavioral Medicine and Technology with Dr. Brennan Armshaw. Anyways, so welcome, guys. Happy Friday. This is the Atypical Behavior Analyst. I am your host, Kelly. And yeah, thanks for joining us. I really have enjoyed getting back into our live talks. We had kind of a hiatus over the summer with a bunch of my traveling and just trying to get things scheduled. And so now we've had several in the last few weeks. And again, the really cool thing that I've enjoyed is seeing these common threads that go throughout when I'm talking to people and I'm getting to learn from them. And a lot of them stem from being curious and creative and, you know, seeing people's histories and again, how those contingencies built and then how they start to kind of follow. And I don't know, I like seeing the patterns of it. And so it's been really fun to see these themes. And one that we're continuing in this discussion is this concept of like the scientist practitioner. And in our previous ones, especially our lives lately, we've been discussing it from looking at kind of who we're working with, but still staying in a commonly known area of the behavior analytic sciences of working with animals or working with humans that have disabilities or schools, working with caregivers. So we're going to go like sideways and maybe slightly down because it's space. So there's no north, south, it's up, down, you know, whatever. I learned it from Ender's Game. But yeah, so we're going to go like sideways and down and we're going to look at how we can apply these things and we can translate the science and make some really cool improvements in the medical field. So, and I'm selfishly interested in this because I have two absolutely horrid knees from hypermobility and too many years of playing sports and not taking care of myself. So yeah, when I saw that Brennan was doing research, you know, with knees, that got me interested. And then as we started talking, learning about making those relationships and those collaborations with other professionals, and not just in the fact that, hey, that puts us in contact with really cool research, but it opens up the possibilities for the science and it helps out other humans as well. So, which is kind of, you know, the be all end all goal anyway, what we're supposed to be doing, which is, you know, helping people with behavior analytic science. So anyways, welcome, Brennan. it's my long kind of rambling discussion. And I did, he and I were chatting earlier, and this is one of those like moments where I'm super proud and happy because I've been able to watch Brennan's career evolve and grow to this amazingness from an RBT all the way through his PhD, which is, like I said, just been super rad. So again, all the more reason I'm excited because there's a wealth of information in your brain. And I'm glad that we get to tap into a little bit of it today. So yay. Thank you. I'm so glad we get to hang out.
I am too. Thanks for having me on here. It's exciting. Yeah. Like you said, kind of full circle. This is kind of cool.
Yeah. Cause yeah, now you are, I will let you give your whole story, but you are teaching, or our professor, at West Virginia University. So If you would give a little bit of time and kind of give your story, your background, how you found the science, what your path was kind of like, where your curiosity and creativity comes in. And then we'll get into, what exactly your dissertation was on.
Definitely. Yeah, I think like so many behavior analysts, I had no idea behavior analysis was a thing before I knew it was a thing. I started off like as a psychology major, graduating, and realized like with a bachelor's in psychology, you can do so many jobs. You're just so qualified to get everything. And I was like, dude, what do I do now that I'm so gainfully able to be employed? Hopefully the sarcasm comes through via Zoom. And while doing that, I started looking around for like opportunities, and I stumbled a friend of mine actually, hey, stumbled across a job working with individuals with autism with Curtis, as you know, Kelly. And they said, hey, this job plays pretty well. Have you thought about looking at that? I was like, yeah, it looks cool. I had been growing up, I had like volunteered and worked with individuals with autism. I grew up my parents running group homes. And so like I was familiar with like working and interacting with individuals from varying ages with different disabilities and things like that. And so while I was trying to figure out grad school and stuff like that, I figured I would go and check that out. At the time, I was like, okay, this give me some money. I can survive while I write my grad school applications to go into neuroscience or clinical psychology. Because like those are the places you go if you want to keep going. Like those are the big, cool, flashy names for study. But as I started to work in behavior analysis more and more and read more about it, I think my introductions to behavior analysis was largely I like Science and Human Behavior with Skinner. I read some of Gold Diamond stuff and some Carl Binder. So not necessarily the traditional, like, here's your first few reads. But I was like, whoa, we can begin to talk about behavior this way. We can put someone else in control of their environment and teach them how to start to manipulate and change things and get not only that, but it works and it makes a huge difference in people's lives. And I can see that change and it's tangible. And not only does it change their life, but it changes the entire unit, particularly with an individual with autism and like the whole family. I was doing in-home at the time. So I was interacting with siblings and parents and their kids and really seeing how we could help them and arrange those environments. And that's when I started to like, well, do I really want to go and be a neuroscientist? This behavior stuff's kind of cool. And I was fortunate that the company I was working at had deep ties to UNT. And so they're like, hey, if you really like this stuff and you want to see how deep that rabbit hole goes and how broadly the science can be applied, you should go to U the University of North Texas. So almost kind of on a whim, really, I was like, okay, I'll send an application to UNT. We'll see what happens. I was still like leaning towards going more of the neuroscience or clinical psychology route at the time. And then I heard back from UNT. They were like, yeah, you could come. It's like, oh, okay. Well, then I have some thinking to do. And I remember like I picked up the Science and Human Behavior again. I was flipping through some of the later p chapters of it, where Skinner starts to break out a little more, talking about dreaming and things like that. And I was like, okay, maybe this is worth a shot. And so I ended up going to UNT. I remember I started in Dr. Shihan's Tracy's lab before I even started there. Like I moved there. I wrote the professors like I find your lab interesting. And Tracy's like, awesome. Come up to my house now, and we're gonna do work. I was like, what? Okay. Semester hasn't started. I don't know anybody. And we there we go. And from there I started like jumping into like everyone's lab as everyone any lab I could, and starting to see how the science could be applied. Because the more and more I learned, the more diverse I realized we could begin to apply things. And then the shift from like that like education focused instructional design, direct instruction techniques, inner teaching, and all of that is where I dove in initially. And then I remember, oh, it was during an orientation for one of the cohorts. And Manish had just gotten back from sabbatical. And he comes up and he gives his spiel and he's like, I'm starting over. Manish 2.0. I'm no longer doing pigeon research. I'm going to do tech and health. Who's interested? I was like, yeah. So I showed up to his lab. It was just me and him to begin with. And he's like, I have this device. I don't know what we're going to do with it yet. It measures. I've been working with this tech company. They're a startup. They couldn't get it to work. They were initially trying to use it for Parkinson's. They created a glove that would allow you to, because it's an electromyograph device, which measures muscle contractions, right, as it fires. And so he said, they built this device. They put it in this robotic glove that when the device fired, that it had read a signal in your hand, like of your muscles moving, but not quite enough to actually make a grasp on a glass, the robotics would close the rest of the way. And they had great success with it in the sense that it would close. And they had it on people and it was working. But then once you took the glove off and then you asked them, pick up the glass, as you can imagine, Kelly, they were like, no strength was regained. No operant control over the muscle had been reestablished. And so the tech company in that sense was a little disheartened of it. But hopefully, whatever was clicking for everyone right now, and what clicked for Manish, and then what clicked for me when he started telling me that story was, well, yeah, because you created a piece of technology, which is fantastic and really cool, but what you forgot to do is all of the behavioral side of things. Let me actually thin out that support, that prompt, how much the robot does. Let me increase the response requirements from you, dial up the intensity of that contraction you have to engage in. And so when he told them that, they said, if you can figure this stuff out and how to make this device useful, this tiny little Bluetooth capable EMG device, then go for it. So then Manish came to me and says, go figure out how to make this useful. And he just tossed me the device. And that's how I ended up into the health side of things. And from there, it was just playing. And figuring things out like that. I don't know if you have any questions based off of that or comments there, Kelly.
No, I think you tacked it beautifully of, what it was the one thing that they were missing. And that's where I see a lot of like, this is a really cool adaptive aid. But again, if we're still able to get some teaching and some muscular response in there, then the adaptive aid can fade out, or it's still, yeah, that person gets more control back, which if we want to go, bodily autonomy and everything, like that's amazing. Okay, so let's get into then the shift. How did we go from working with hands and Parkinson's to going into like rehab and everything, and then I specifically into the knees?
So I think so. Part of this was we didn't get the whole glove. I think the initial plan was to eventually get back into it. And I think it's still on the horizons. But the complexity of the response is something that's always, I think, important. And as behavior analysts who are trying to move into the medical domains, I think like I'd stress the importance of being aware of like how complex is the system that I'm trying to jump into. Parkinson's, there's a lot of unknowns. And so that system is inherently going to be more complex. And when I'm thinking about how the contingencies apply, that really, really matters. And so what we started with was just trying to figure out, well, is there an operant here when we're talking about these kind of incipient, really small muscle twitch sort of behaviors? There's some literature to suggest that there is. We all know the invisible thumb twitch paper by Heferlein and Keenan. So there's
Yeah,
a
no, I was gonna
Heferlein.
say, hold on. I will be the honest one here. I am not familiar with this, or if it's been years if I am.
It's a really, really old paper. But it's a Heferlein and Keenan. They have there's they measured the right, they've set up operant contingencies without the organisms really being aware of like what was producing the reinforcer. And what was these really minute twitches in the thumb. And then they were able to increase the frequency of that But when you ask the organism, what were they doing to produce the reinforcer? They had no idea, because it was occurring at such a low level and they weren't telling them at all, but that was the response. And so they were able to show as operant control, it was reliably producing the reinforcer. They were able to shift it and move it around. But because it was occurring at such a low level, they weren't able to tact it, which is why they call it like the invisible thumb twitch.
That's absolutely fascinating.
And so we have that literature to kind of suggest that there's something there. And so that was kind of the premise of some of that stuff.
Okay. Which is fabulous because, you know, the implications of that are phenomenal because, again, you know, a lot of these motor responses, they are so minutiae that, you know, to the naked eye, if you will, they're not noticeable. And so if you have someone who's having a difficult mm-hmm. time learning, and you know, doesn't maybe possess the sophistication to tact those kind of small behaviors, like you could even work with, it sounds like, someone that has a disability or some kind of cognitive deficit and produce some improvements as well. Maybe I'm jumping too far ahead.
No, I think you're completely right. I don't think you need to, right? It's kind of the beauty of our science, right? Is we can begin to teach and establish these sorts of responses if we can reliably measure the behavior and program sophisticated contingencies dependent on that response. And so the complexity of being able to tact and describe exactly how or what you're doing isn't always necessary. The verbal behavior, in other words, doesn't always have to be able to be overlaid for you to begin able to engage in the action, which is often what we find in the knee stuff, which, jumping a little bit ahead on that, right?
Yeah, totally. Go for it. Because I was going to say, let's go. You know, we talked about, you mentioned units earlier, and I was thinking, yeah, you can look at the units from a micro level of this muscular structure and then build it outwards into the unit as all the systems in play. So yeah, let's start with that. So the knee, how did we get to the knee? How did you get to the knee?
Yeah, so we got to the knee because of physical therapy, really. We had some connections with a physical therapy clinic and an orthopedic surgeon. And I guess this starts to tie into that collaboration sort of side of things. And so it became a natural segue because we had some sorts of relations with this clinic. And then it was just a matter of like, well, will they let us actually get in there and play? And that's where the knee comes in. And so we show up there and we're like, I spent a summer like in the physical therapy clinic. I'm talking to them, like working with them. I'm like, I become a physical therapy tech pretty much for a summer. Like that's what I spend my time, like running the ultrasound, taking patients through exercises, all sorts of things like that. An experience I never thought I would get when I signed up to go be a behavior analyst. But lo and behold, that's what I was doing. And as I was there, I was having these conversations with the physical therapists, with the orthopedic surgeon, with the clinical director about recovery rate for patients. Like, when do things go really well? When do things not go well? What are some of the issues you guys run into? Is there like one big area? And the response to that was always the knees. And then shoulders, but the knees was the biggest. It says recovery following knee surgery, particularly total knee replacement surgery, which impacts a lot of people. Imagine everyone here knows someone who's had their knee replaced. I usually, if I'm presenting, I'll do the show of hands and the talk. And to this day, I haven't run into the issue where the people don't raise their hands. So that's good. And for me, not for them, and so that's where we got to the knees, is this conversation about, okay, what's the problem? Which I think is one of the most important things we can do when we're trying to establish collaborative relationships, is being problem oriented. I think there's probably like a few like key things I would say we should keep in mind with that is find the problem that first and foremost they care about. Because if it's a problem that they care about, now there's a reinforcer tied to it. And so there's something we can begin to provide them. Like solving this problem is going to be a reinforcer to them. And so then it's more likely that their behavior starts to organize in the way that you're suggesting might be beneficial. which ultimately we're going to request something. And the other is like this weird balance, I think, as behavior analysts, we kind of, we get trained up when we go into like hoorah, rah, everyone behaves. And since everybody behaves, obviously, our subject matter is all of it. And we're an expert in all of those things, which is no. We are experts in operant control and learning. Like, that's our area. And because someone behaves and that there are likely, and because there may be operant contingencies at play, doesn't mean that's the summative whole of that dynamic. Physical therapists have a lot of expertise. They went to school for a long time. Orthopedic surgeons have a lot of expertise. They went to school for a long time. They know things that I don't know. They know things that, quite frankly, I know a bit about, but I don't want to be an expert in it. I'm not going to be an orthopedic surgeon. That's not my aspiration. I'm glad it was someone else's. And so we need to set aside that degree of arrogance a little bit and say, I have a piece of the puzzle, but not the whole solution. I want you to bring your expertise and I'll bring mine. But I think on the flip side, we sometimes end up going to the so far other extreme, where you want to be the fly on the wall. I don't know anything. You're the experts. I'm just going to listen, which it's important to listen, but not to the extent that you're saying, I don't know anything, because you do, right? And if you don't know anything, then you don't really have anything to offer to them, and which takes us right back to the problem solving aspect. It was like, I can help solve that problem. You're saying the problem is someone goes through this exercise, they have a total knee replacement surgery, they get their knee replaced, they go through 2 months of physical therapy, they come to my clinic, and I take a look at them, and they have really, really strong hamstrings, but the quads that they were supposed to be exercising the entire time during physical therapy are nothing. They were never strengthening those. They're still weak. They still have a limited gait. That's my problem. They went through they did all the exercises. They were in the clinic. They received physical therapy, but they did the exercises wrong. Okay. I can help with that. There's a piece of a problem. If I can measure it and I can arrange contingencies, I can now teach them to contract the right muscle. So it was really those sorts of conversations that then ended up taking us full circle and bringing us to the knee.
There's so much coolness in everything you just said. There's like several things that I was like, yeah, yeah, like that is it was beautifully spoken. And especially the looking at, you know, we are I love how you tacked it, you know, we are experts in operant and in learning. And so what do we do? You looked at, where does this person have an issue with learning, or where is the problem with the learning portion of it? Oh, it's here on which muscles are being developed and what, you know, or used and everything. And so it's fabulous. I also really like the fact that you had to go through and you spent so much time essentially on the ground with everybody else learning what they're going through. Cause that's where you start to learn also that you hold on to your little knowledge bucket here of what are the competing contingencies, because not only is it, you know, putting certain things in place, but there's also, you know, they can't, you know, they didn't know the movement correctly, or they had this other thing to do. So you're also getting to have that feedback from people as well. And then being able to say, okay, now I know how to make this super successful because I'm already taking into consideration all of these other pieces, and then having the conversation also of you know, what do they want solved? You know, and being able to also help them realize, like, you know, narrow down what the problems are. Cause I think for some of us, we get called in to solve a problem regardless of which population you're working with. And it's like, well, there's this, 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 and this. And so being able to have those conversations with multiple people and say, commonalities here, man, like I see this, 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 and this across the board. Let's hone in here. That's super rad. Okay. So, I don't know, you're not an orthopedic surgeon, but I'm sure you had to learn a little bit about just like, can you give like maybe a quick summary of like what exactly is involved in that, and then why PT is so important?
Yeah. So the surgery themselves are extraordinarily successful when it comes to replacing the knees and building all this infrastructure and taking away that tissue. That's usually it's knee osteoarthritis is the primary reason people go and have their knees replaced, right? So knee osteoarthritis is this condition where that tissue begins to degrade and break down, which eventually leads to bone on bone rubbing, which is extremely painful, as you can probably imagine. And when we think from a behavioral standpoint, I think this is one of the things that I was always in the back of my head as I was talking to the orthopedic surgeons, the physical therapist, as I was doing my own reading, running in the back of my head is, okay, well, if it's really painful, I bet people aren't walking around on it very much. And they're not, right? So what is that? Okay, we have an avoidance response. There's an aversive stimulus. I want to avoid that aversive stimulus. I don't want to be in pain all the time. And so they don't walk. And so their muscles begin to weaken. So that's one of the first components that really are why like physical therapy is so important, is because the strength of the muscle has started to decrease even before surgery, severe atrophy. Then the other side of it is you have during surgery, there's these proprioceptive nerves, right, that we have throughout our body to kind of allow us to understand through space and positioning where our muscles are. The reason you could pick up a glass and you pick it up with, you're able to get that tactile feedback about how much I should pick up, things like that. Your ability to feel how your muscles and your body is moving and the amount of force being produced and things like that relies on that proprioceptive feedback that we get. Surgery can just break down some of those nerve feelings and things like that. And so when you're asking someone, and this goes back to the issue with learning that I kind of talked about earlier, to now engage those muscles, you're dealing with a muscle that's already weakened. So we have an high response effort. And you're dealing with muscles that no longer feel like when I use them, it doesn't feel quite the same way. It's kind of like relearning how to walk. Because what used to make your muscles move no longer feels right. It's not doing it. It's changed. You're not getting the same feedback. So the feedback loop you're used to kind of broke. And so that kind of begins to contribute. If we think about it behaviorally now, and we start to kind of interpret that on the fly, we have high effort response, no longer we're getting feedback. So I engage in behavior. It's really difficult. It doesn't produce a consequence. There's, extinction. And so what we end up with is kind of like this localized extinction of effort. And so you have these physical therapy patients now who they need to build it because of severe muscle atrophy. But because of this extinction process of, paired with this high effort response, they either have really poor compliance and they don't do them at all, or they end up engaging the wrong muscle because they're getting feedback when that muscle's engaging. And so they end up going through this whole sequence of physical therapy, producing a consequence, but the wrong sort of consequence, and not actually engaging in the proper response, which is contracting and working on building and strengthening those quadricep muscles again.
That was really, I love the the term feedback loops, because it really is, it's seeing how that cycle continues. And when there is a disruption somewhere, how it breaks down afterwards. I mean, you see this in organizations. If you give feedback to someone and it's just telling them to do the thing and you don't have any action steps to follow up, what's going to happen? There's no change. And so it's beautiful to see how that just kind of layers down across things. So, okay, cool. So we have, so not only are you having to battle a little bit too with, you know, a person's with, you know, just the muscular structure, but also the nerves too. I'd forgotten, you know, how much detriment that can do if you aren't able to feel what's going on. Or like you said, it feels differently now. As you were saying that, I'm sitting here kind of looking at my own, because I, this is more information you guys ever need, but like I blew out my knee a year and a half ago. It was the most beautiful set I've ever had. I got my point. I'm happy, but I hyperextended my knee. And I'm just now to a point where my knee looks like a knee again. And yeah, I've caught myself walking a few times going, oh, that feels different. And yeah, because it is different now. And that's something that I think people really strongly need to consider, is that this is your new baseline. And so now how do we go from here? And which is kind of nice. So, because I like to see that build instead of going, oh man, I was here and now I dropped. And it's like, well, okay, let's get rid of that. Call this your new baseline and let's build. So let's talk about that building process then. So is this, it's not something that was like implanted. So I'm assuming like a wrap or something. So what was the mechanism itself?
Yeah, so the mechanism itself is a really beautiful, it's an electromyograph. So it's a surface EMG device. And I mentioned it earlier, but I'll say again, just a little bit, like what that does is it measures the electrical activity. So when our muscles contract, there's an electrical signal that's running through them. I won't go too into the weeds of like the physiology side of things for why that happens. But the more of that, the more electrical, more electric pulse that's going into the muscle, the stronger, the harder, the more force that muscle is going to be producing. And so what a surface EMG device does, surface, as in it's going to rest on the surface of your skin above the muscles, which is different than the intramuscular EMG devices, which are thin needles and go into the actual muscle bed. So the surface, it just rests on your skin. And what it does is it measures the electrical signals, that electrical pulse that is being carried in the muscles. And so when we flex, right, and you flex to the point where you can see it, the muscles are going, but you're probably engaging in more force. With a patient who's undergone knee surgery and their muscles are severely atrophied and really weak, they're not engaging very much force. And so there's not something you can see, but you can still measure. There's still an electrical signal that's likely going. And this is kind of where that extinction comes in, is and fixing that loop is, well, we can measure it. So we can place it just with some like kind of like stickers that tab onto it, little adhesives. And we place that on the quadricep, particularly the vastus medialis oblique or the VMO. It's kind of a teardrop shaped muscle in the quads, right on the inside. Yeah, if you were to stick your leg out and you see that one right above the kneecap, it kind of looks like a little bit like a teardrop sort of shape.
It's like the bodybuilder muscle. Like that's one that I feel the bodybuilders always try to really highlight.
Yep. That you want to get it. It's that. There you go.
Okay.
I think you're the first person to describe it as that, but I'm not going to steal that and say the bodybuilder one, guys. Because it's good. It's a great instant, like, oh yeah, I've seen that. So it goes on that muscle and it just rests there. And so when we ask a patient to contract that muscle, now we're able to measure it even if they can't see it. So you might be having a patient initially who's engaging in like 150 microvolts. And to contextualize that a little bit, if I'm going to engage mine, I might be at like 12,000 microvolts. And so there's a huge difference. And where in mind, you could see it tense up and things like that, and you won't be able to see that with the patients. What physical therapists typically rely on to tell a patient they're doing the right thing is they palpate the muscle. And so they come in there with their hands and they massage out that muscle when you're having it act so that they push it in so that they can kind of feel any sorts of small changes, which works. But it also would require a physical therapist then to be there holding your leg every time you do those exercises for the entire time, saying you did the right one, you did the wrong one, which is never going to happen. It's too demanding. Physical therapists have all these patients running around. There's their techs. They're taking in new patients in and going through all of that. It's not feasible they have too many competing contingencies. And so what the EMG device allows, that surface electromyograph, is to measure that. So there's the measurements, right? So you have a behavior, or we think behavior, right? And we're measuring it. So there's a first step as a behavior analyst. I can measure it. That's good. I feel good. The next thing that rolls around, though, is that contingency side. Can I actually program something that's going to change that behavior? And for that, a colleague of mine, Russell Silgaro, used to be doing a bunch of computer programming. When he took a break after his master's before jumping back into the PhD, he was working as a computer programmer. So he's like a whiz with apps and helped develop some apps. I'd be like, hey, I really need to do this or that. And so what he developed is these apps to go on an Android-based devices, communicate with that flex dot. And as the electrical signal gets read by the device, that EMG, it's sent to my phone or a tablet, and I can program feedback. So I can say, okay, you're at, I get your baseline. You're at 150, 200 microvolts. Cool. I like what you said, right? We're not comparing to where you were. We're looking at where you are now. It's a new baseline. Let's increase that. Let's set a goal. Let's reliably start hitting it. I developed a procedure during my master's that we utilized in this. And the way the procedure worked for kind of getting a baseline was kind of using an extinction burst sort of technique. Because what it's called in the literature is this thing called a maximum voluntary isometric contraction, or MVIC. It just means the most you could contractile force you can produce in a non-bending sort of movement, right? That's where the isometric comes in. In the literature, the way they typically get an MVIC is they tell their participants or their patients to flex as hard as you can. And they'll do that probably 3 times. And then they'll take the average and they'll say, that's your maximum, purely based off instructions only. To me as a behavior analyst, I was like, I don't know about instructions only. Just say, hey, go ahead, flex real hard for me. We'll see how that goes. And then you look at some of the literature and then you find, well, hang on. I thought their maximum was 300 microvolts. How come while in they're doing the exercise, they're at 800 microvolts? What? Well, because instructions only don't necessarily promote the maximum effort. And so what I did is I developed a procedure where I built in a history of reinforcement. It's like really easy. Flex a little bit, flex a medium amount, flex a little bit harder. Reinforcement, 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 and then discontinue reinforcement to relying on extinction to lead to a burst, a harder contraction. Because hang on, why am I not getting my auditory tone? Which is the reinforcer in this case. Just a simple ding. You'd be amazed of how much people can care about a ding. I'm like, I was worried it wouldn't be an effective reinforcer, but man.
Well, I think it's one of those, you explain, I'm assuming you explain this to them of like, here's why we're doing it. If you hear this tone, that means that you're increasing the strength in your muscle, which means you're going to be improving your leg, which means you're going to get stronger and we can get back to where you want it to be. Like when we can explain that contingency, like, well then heck yes, I want to hear the stupid ding. Because yep. I want to get stronger. I want to get back to whatever my life was before this. I don't want to have, you know, be stuck in the house all day kind of deal. And so, oh, the beauty of that is phenomenal. So the one question I do have for you on the ding, did they get to pick their ding?
Not yet. But I think that's one of the areas that I want to play with going forward. Cause I think you're right. Giving more and more, like I think what really makes this useful is kind of what you started to say, right? Was because we lay it out for them, because we're telling them all these things, because they get to know where they're going and working back to where they want to be, they're becoming more and more empowered in their own physical therapy. It goes to that whole push in the medical field now for patient-centered care, right? Where it's a team of collaborators, but that team of collaborators includes the patient. And so what we're doing is trying to empower patients. This, I think, is a way in a physical therapy sort of sense to do exactly that. You now as the patient, the physical that I'm working with, you know how you're doing, you know when you're doing it right, you are able to increase how hard you're doing, and you can track it. The next step to that would be like, let's let you pick your reinforcer. What is tone do you get? When we go into the exercise side of things, I added a conjugate feedback bar, which is like a little bar and conjugate being like, it's kind of matched. The amount of reinforcement gets matched to the amount of effort or behavior you're producing. And so as a bar, and the harder you flex, the more full the bar gets, and the less you flex, the less full you get. And so another step would be like, pick the color of your bar, pick the shape. Maybe you want a bucket. You want to fill the bucket with water. These are all things because it's an app that we can begin to customize and build in that not only are cool to me personally, but also is a one step towards putting the patient more and more empowered of the physical therapy. They're customizing it, which means they're going to work harder when I'm with them. But also, one of my ultimate goals is develop a package that I can just send it to you, go home with it. You don't need me. I've programmed the contingencies. I want you to be the one driving it. So if I make it what you want, I've empowered you to the point that this is basically your thing. You're running your own exercises. You're working yourself. You chose your reinforcer. All of these things, we might begin to combat what we see with huge issues with noncompliance. You talk to physical therapists, one of their biggest concerns beyond they can't flex the right muscle is I give them a list of exercises, they go home, and then they come back to me and I'm like, no, you didn't do any of your exercises since you saw me last. Me too.
All right, just a quick pause in the action to give you the first of your two keywords if you are listening for CEUs. Your first word is no, K-N-O-W. To stay within one scope, know what you don't know.
I'm super guilty. Yeah, we're all guilty of that, I think. I hate to interrupt you on this, but there's so many cool things that I kind of want to just highlight with that is, it's that empowerment side of things. And there's always a lot of discussion across the field and across the different, settings that we play in as behavior analysts of how do I get the person to do it when they're at home? When I leave, because I should not be the stimulus to make you do the thing. It has to be something else that motivates people. So yeah, little things that we can throw in that may seem silly and some people may find them silly. Okay, fine. But there's other things that they find that are fun. And so cool, we just program those things. And like, they may not, care about a bar, changing a different color as they increase their strength, but they do like the musical tone or something like that. Like there's so many cool areas. Again, the creativity and the curiosity that can happen is beautiful. And I think this also lays wonderfully with the concept of what we've been talking about as a scientist practitioner, is being able to see a thing and go, okay, this looks familiar. And it looks like this other thing. And so we layer, as I always call them, vectors. I still know that's the correct term, but you layer a little behavior analytic vector over it, the lens, you go, ooh, I do see some potentials for behavior. And it looks like there's an antecedent. And now how do you make the contingency happen around it? Mm-hmm. Which I think is beautiful. So I guess let's talk now about, the process of it. So were you the one doing all of the things? What was that? Did you have them doing some things? Did you fade out? Like what did that look like? What was your program essentially for it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think for a number of reasons, one being this was for my dissertation and I wanted to run cleanly so I could graduate, selfish, but they were goals. I programmed everything. I ran it all. I think the other side of that is one of the things I wanted to do was make sure I was developing a technology that in no way would add extra burden to the physical therapists, the techs, or the patients at the time. And so as I was going through this, I wanted to be there to see how much time it was taking me to do things, what sort of things I could do to improve, decrease response effort on the person implementing and running it all, so that we begin to create a technology that doesn't increase the effort in any way on anyone. From a procedural sort of day in the life sort of thing, a couple of those driving factors were not wanting to increase any, and the other was we didn't want to in any way take away from the patient's physical therapy. I think that was one of the big drivers there is like, I don't want to be going in there. And while I may have spent 2 years doing translational research with undergrads and looking at and developing these procedures before I even stepped into working in the physical therapy clinic, it was still a bit of a research question. Did I have some confidence? Did I have evidence to suggest that it would be more successful? Yes. But I still wanted to do it in a way that I was never detracting from their physical therapy. So we did one exercise, the quad sets. It's a 10-minute long exercise. Half our patients went through and they received exactly how the physical therapists run it with neuromuscular electrical stimulation. It's a device that just stimulates the muscle for you. It contracts it. It's kind of like a prompting procedure, or perhaps you might conceptualize it as an eliciting response where it's being stimulated. You're not engaging in any voluntary contraction, right? That's how they typically would do quad sets. And they tell you to flex along with it.
So is that like a TENS unit?
So I'd have it.
Okay.
Yep. It's like a TENS unit. Yep. Very similar to a TENS unit. Same sort of concept where you're, you know, if people have used TENS or something like that, you know, it squeezes your muscles in for you. That's how they do it. And then they're supposed to like flex along with it. So for a number of reasons, there might be issues with that, which depending on time, we could geek out and talk about that. The flip side of it is the biofeedback one, right? That's our EMG. That's our contingencies that we've developed. They completed the same exact exercise, 10 minutes. There's 30 contractions during that 10-minute period of time. The only difference was we did that MVIC procedure I talked about with the extinction burst to set their goal at the start of every single session. I was like, okay, let's see how you're doing today. We're going to set your goal based off of that. So it's individualized every time I see you. And then we programmed the feedback based off of that. The auditory tone was set at 75% of their master. So like their max, so that they were likely to produce a reinforcer. But the visual bar was set at 100% of the max they were capable of doing during the extinction burst. And so that they could see how they could get closer and closer. And so we'd go through that exercise. I worked with them for the full time they were in physical therapy. So 8 weeks, twice a week, I would see them. I did three different assessment dates. So I measured at the very beginning, I ran them through the assessments, which I'll describe in a moment. At the halfway point, ran them through those assessments. And then at the end, before discharge, we ran through the assessments. And those assessments included measures that through a lit review were consistently like in the orthopedics, kinesiology, physical therapy journals. When they look at this, these were the measures that they were including. So I wanted to see, okay, what does that community care about? How are they measuring success? Let me measure it that way. With the exception of I included my MVIC procedure to measure strength, because just telling them to flex as hard as they could didn't seem to be a very good way to go about doing it based off of some of the evidence I had from my thesis, my master's thesis. So we had that one to measure strength, the reinforcement, extinction. How strong is it? We measured range of motion, because that's another really big thing is you have decreased range of motions, and range of motion being particularly important because when we're looking at a natural gait and being able to have functional utility of your knee needs to be strong, but your knee also has to have that range of motion. And both of those are often very compromised in patients following total knee replacement. The third was a functional measure. I really absolutely love this measure. It's called the TUG, the timed up go. It's a procedure that has you sit in a chair. I start my timer and say go. The patient then stands up. They walk to the wall. They touch the wall, 30 feet. They turn around. They return to their seat and they sit back down and I stop it. It's such a beautifully like clean measure when we think about functional utility, because it's like, great, what do we have to be able to do? Well, I have to be able to go from a seated to a standing position. I need to be able to walk. As my gait gets better, the speed of that's going to improve. So it's really capturing all these things you're going to need your knee for in a daily life. And it does it really fast and neatly. And the fourth was a qualitative measure. There's a short form 12, it's the RAND. And this is just a set of questions that ask about like the impact of the pain, the impact of your knee on your quality of life, how much is it still impeding? Are you able to go up and down stairs? It's more self-reported sort of stuff. And we would take those measures at those three different points in time.
That's really cool. I've seen the TUG acronym across a few different things. Mm-hmm. And so it's fascinating to see that it's also in the physical therapy world. Because I think the first time I saw it was catchers in baseball. But yeah, it's anything essentially. It's just the time to get up and go. So yeah, that's cool. And looking at, again, what is the purpose of this? Why do we need to have this? And being able, because that why is so important. If you don't have your why, you don't really have anything else. Like, there's no motivation that's there. And also it really limits our understanding of what's going on. You know, if I just tell you to move your knee a certain way and I only look at it from this way and never from functionally, like, what does a person do on their day to day? I, you know, turn over in the bed. I have to stand up. I have to, you know, use my hands to do things. And it's so important to take in that whole picture as well and not just get so focused in on, like, it has to look like this. Well, it has to look like this in all of these situations. And so how are we accounting for those other variables as we're doing this? Well, we look at them and we measure.
I think you very really beautifully said, Kelly. I think it's kind of highlights what the driving factor, right? It has to be a functional improvement. When we look at some of the issues in literature surrounding the recovery following total knee replacement surgery, is while the surgery itself is super successful, the physical therapy side of things, from functional improvement, evidence suggests like 50% of patients never achieve a full functional recovery. And so their daily lives are continue to be adversely impacted 2 years beyond surgery because they were never fully functionally recovered. And so when we were assessing the metrics, I didn't want to just be like, is it stronger? Yes, good job. I wanted to be, well, did we actually make a functional difference that would allow one to tick that 50% and move it? But two, it also like make a difference in the patient's life. When they leave, are they going to be better? Is their life improved? And I say quality of life a bunch, just because I think is one of the most important things when we're trying to go out here. And why I say, even though I like doing behavior analysis a little bit differently, like I'm an applied behavior analyst, because the driving factor for me is applying the science to improve the quality of life of the individuals I'm working with. Like, can I take the limited degrees of freedom? Oh, you can't go up your stairs and can't go to the grocery store. And can I increase those degrees of freedom for you? Does going through that expand that? I think that's an important thing for us to always have in the back of our head as applied behavior analysts, is like, well, it's not just social validity, it's quality of life and its relation to expanding degrees of freedom.
I'm so excited about the research and the literature that's starting to come out about degrees of freedom, because it's a beautiful way to think about things. Because I think a lot of people, as you know, caregivers or teachers or behavior analysts, like however you fall in, if you've worked with somebody, you've had to teach them a thing, taking that step back and realizing how many choices am I giving you in these situations is so important. Because oftentimes I see with my adult individuals is their choices become so limited as they get older. And it's due to a variety of reasons, but it's like they're in a group home. And so morning wake up time is dictated. When you go to dayhab is dictated. When you get done with dayhab is, you know, we have a schedule. And so it's like, there's these limited times for a person to make a choice. And we see problem, quote unquote, behavior emerge because of it. So yeah, when we start building in this idea of, like you said, it's not just social validity. It's not just, did you like this? Was it successful? Yada, yada. But more of, yeah, did it actually improve this person's life? Like, that's, it's, I don't know. It's, I don't know. It's empowering. You said it earlier. It empowers that person. And then also selfishly makes us feel good because hopefully that person is having a better life now. So kind of going into that, then what were the results that you saw from this? You know, both nerdy data stuff and then also on the side of quality of life.
Yeah. Nerdy data stuff first, just cause I like it. And then also like quality of life. Don't want to sound like I don't, but we'll talk about that next. But I love basic research. I love all that nerdy stuff still, even though like I'm passionate about the applied side. When we look at the strengths, right, which is the measure that we directly intervened on. And so it's the one I thought we would, if it worked, we would see the greatest difference. So I remember like we saw such a stark difference that I was like, as the data was coming out, I was like, no one's going to believe this. And then there was one patient who didn't show as much of a change. Like they had the same improvements. I was like, now it's believable data. That's good. But we found for the majority of these patients, like those who went through our procedure relative to the neuromuscular sort of procedure, improved between 2 and 5 times more in contraction strength than those in the other, the neuromuscular group. And while everyone improved, we saw a 2 to 5 times stronger muscle contraction for those patients than we did for the others. So we had whopping effects on that. But again, we weren't just concerned about strength. So we had that range of motion measure. And what we found with range of motion, really interestingly, is for the neuromuscular patients, again, everyone improved, but we saw this dispersion where 50% of patients seem to get close to that 120-ish, right around 110 degrees of range of motion, 120 being like optimal, unless you had hypermobility, Kelly. No. But 50% of them stayed right around like a 60-80 range of motion. So not getting back to where they need to be at all. So we saw that evidence of, oh, hey, there's that 50%. But in our biofeedback group, every participant improved to that 110-ish degree to 120 degree range of motion. So what we were able to do is, well, is we were able to take that 50% difference and get rid of that. We saw similar effects when we looked at the timed up go results, where all patients in the biofeedback group went from like taking 30 to 50-ish seconds to complete this down to around 12 to walk that 30 feet. Whereas in the neuromuscular groups, some patients got down to that same interval, but we still had a chunk that were closer to a 20 to 18 second sort of completion ratio, which ends up being a lot when we start thinking we're dealing with seconds. Graphically, they kind of look close, but when you start to map out and like, well, 12 seconds versus 16 seconds is a big difference.
Yeah. You don't realize it until you're editing audio and you're like, oh, I took a really long time to pause there. Yeah. And think about like expanding it too. If there is an emergency or something like that, and then you're more, you know, you're doing it and you're aware of what's going on. Like I was given an instruction. I'm aware that I'm standing up and I'm walking and everything. And as someone recovering with, you know, knee injuries, you kind of become very aware of that. But yeah, if they're not to a point where they're going to be safe making that kind of transition quickly, holy shnikes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's, you know, if it's time to get across the crosswalk or something like that, well, that makes a big, that difference actually starts to matter. And we saw similar effects through the survey as well, where what we generally saw, if left were most impacted and right-based responses where I'm feeling excellent, over time, what we saw is, well, everyone shifted to the right in their responses. We would see like a shift from poor to good or very good in our neuromuscular participants, but a shift from poor to excellent in the court responding on our biofeedback group. So again, we saw more of a right shift. And this is across all of those participants. And so it ended up being honestly, like a greater effect than I had ever hoped for in relation to this. And not only that, but from like some like a self-support sort of side of things, like I have, there's these patients, like I'm working with them. And one guy asked me like, hey, is there any way I can take this home with me? Another person's like, this is the hardest thing I do here every single time. But it's also the thing I look forward to doing the most because I know how if I'm improving or not. And my favorite person, they would see me like jokingly, like coming in with a device, and he'd run and hide behind one of the techs. This older, he's like probably like, you know, 75, 73 years old. But if I ever I showed up late one time, and he was like, hey, where's Brennan? Am I not doing it today? Is someone else going to let me do this? I need to see how I improved. And so we saw so much of like what we would like, if we were working like individual, like in autism and things like what we would call that approach-based behavior, like they were wanting it. They were coming to me for it. They were wanting more. Someone asked if I could, really lovely older lady was like, is there any way we can use this in all of my exercises so I can see how I'm doing on all of them? And so it was incredible to see like how much approach there was, how much interest they had in it, despite the fact that, as they would describe, like, I'm working really hard. So I'm doing something that's difficult. But because I'm empowered with it, I have control over those contingencies, I can see my progress, that reinforcer matters to me, and I'm being able to visually see it and hear it, I want to engage in that response effort.
Well, it's like, my mind was actually just blown at the fact that these were a couple of older patients that you were talking about, because I had like people in their, you know, 40s and 50s doing this. And so this is going to sound really not harsh, but just probably odd, but like, these are older individuals who typically learning something new, especially a tiny muscular like behavior, would be considered really difficult. Like that would kind of, that's obviously my perception of it. And so I can see how kind of across the board, like working with the gerontology population, you know, oh, they're a little bit slower and things like that. So, oh my gosh, this makes it like so much more impactful too, because, you know, these are extremely vulnerable individuals that need to have that mobility, going back to these freedoms of choice and everything, because again, as you get older, they start to narrow down, because if your mobility and your strength isn't there, how do you access these other environments? Sorry, I just got really excited about that.
Well, I get excited about it too. So I'm glad it's not just me. But yeah, I'd say the population, the majority of them were in their 60s. We had a couple people who were a little bit younger, a couple people who were a little bit older, and one person was like in their 80s. But it was definitely probably average age was probably 66, 67 of these participants. And we still saw these sorts of gains. And we still saw this sort of approach, despite like we're using technology that they're not familiar with, but they were still eager and they wanted to see their progress. They would ask about their progress. They would always, the competitive nature doesn't go away from you when you age, because they're like, and how good can I possibly do? Especially as I started to get like further and further along in the process, they're like, what's the best anyone's ever done? And when I was doing my thesis with undergraduate students, that's what they would ask. But then I'm working with a patient who's 70 years old, just had knee surgery. And now that they're, you know, probably around like week five, week six of this process, now they're asking that exact same question. And to me, I think that it suggests that not only, right, because all the results point to, yes, this made a difference in their recovery. But I think the other side, the flip of these findings, particularly those anecdotes, is, well, it's something that the patients would choose to use, which might mean if we create a package where it's something you can go take home with you, and it walks you through it and it sets all that for you, well, now we might be able to produce a technology that not only makes a difference when we're in the clinic and we're working with you, but also increases compliance. So when you go home and you do your exercises, if you like the thing that you're doing and you're in control of it, which evidence suggests that those patients did, you're more likely to be like, let me put this on, let me improve, and actually do my exercises, which, as we all know, it's always such a tricky thing.
Well, like you mentioned at the beginning, there's a lot of other things that are going on. It's painful. I know where I once was, but now we've reset the baseline, and I mean, you've gamified it, or they naturally gamified it as well. And which is amazing. And it kind of gets us into this, how we talk to other people. And, you know, you and I have spoken, because you also got to experience me early on in my career, where I was very much like, thou shalt use the jargon. And so I apologize to everybody I came in contact with for like the first 3 years. I've learned, I promise, I'm trying to get better. But it was something that, like you said, we get really, you know, we're proud of our science, we're excited by it, we think it's really cool, we've got all these technologies that we can utilize. But we spend a lot of time talking to ourselves, and to other behavior analysts. Sorry, let me say that, other behavior analysts. I talk to myself, but that's a different story. So, but we stay in our little echo chambers, and it's really easy to fall into just using that kind of terminology all the time. But when we go out and you're talking with, you know, orthopedic surgeons, physical therapists, rehab specialists, like they also have their own language that they're very excited about and would like to share as well. And so finding that kind of commonality is really important. So as you guys had an in, which is always nice too. So what was it like kind of building that relationship? And I know you've talked kind of around it a lot, but just, you know, that process and maybe some of the barriers that you came across too, as you were trying to build and, you know, translate all of the sciences, if you will, with just professionals. And we'll start there and then we can move into talking to patients.
Yeah. I think, we did have an in, right? The in being with the orthopedic surgeon. We had from the physical therapist side of things, it was not the case. Particularly one of the physical therapists initially had, they did not think this was going to work. They didn't think it was going to make a difference. They're like, fine, you can be here. But they were kind of cold in that regard, right? They had no buy-in. They were not interested in it. They didn't want to hear about it really much at all. But then as we started to have these conversations, and talk about what I'm trying to do. Right. And so why do you think is not going to work it? But why won't this work? Do you think we're good enough? You think it's working well enough? What differences can you start to see? And starting to solicit their thoughts on it. And when they gave to the thought, and I'd be like, well, what about, do you think about this? Not giving an answer fully and saying, this is law. But starting to open up a dialogue where now I'm not just someone who's coming in because the orthopedic surgeon on the tip top said I can, but someone who's coming in is listening and hearing what you're saying. But I'm not just listening, right? And I think that's one of the important things is I read a bunch of research on physical therapy and on knee injury and all of the dynamics and how muscles work. And so when they started using their words, it wasn't that I'm becoming the expert here, but I'm able to track and engage in the conversation. I think that's is the important side of things. The other is I took all the jargon and I threw it away. I didn't use it because they don't know what the jargon is, and I don't need to use it to explain accurately. Jargon has a lot of utility, like you said, but it's not as you pointed out, it's not something we should be walking around and talking to everybody using the most technical terms. When we're writing and we're engaging in scientific endeavors and we're working within our community, it provides us an important amount of precision. But precision isn't good if it's not going to be able to be communicated. And so I got rid of that. And then the second area is they started to see results. I think that made a huge difference too. And I remember very vividly, one morning I had someone who came in at I think they're 6 a.m. Saturday morning, physical therapy appointment. It was terrible. And I was in Denton and this was in Dallas. So I had to get up at 4:30 in the morning. I wasn't happy, but I'm in there and I'm talking to them because they're the only physical therapist. The other physical therapist comes in later or doesn't even come in on Saturdays. They have different schedules. And so this person's there who's wasn't as happy about it. We're having a conversation and she's like, you know, I was thinking about motivation and how we can motivate people. And I was thinking about what you've been talking about and what you've been and how you've been talking about getting them involved and motivating them and seeing things. And I was like, I think that works. And I was like, and I saw that was okay, there's a crack. And once I saw that, I was wedge myself into it and then run with it. And it was great. We found a common ground where you think there might be a piece. And so every time we have these conversations, and when I was coming in, I was hearkening it back to that. And so I used that bit of common ground, a little bit of give, and it opened it up. It to the point where she started trying to sign up people that are like, hey, they have to go through it and sign an informed consent. We have a process. We can only take them at certain times because we're still in a research sort of dynamic. But she's like, oh no, they're good. They're great. They could use this. It's like, yes, but they had their surgery 3.5 weeks ago. We need to start with them right away. But she's like, oh, but it would make a difference. So that became a different sort of tricky conversation was that, but from that, like, it's not, I don't like the phrase buy-in, because I don't think that's really what we're doing. We're not, you shouldn't be trying to like sell it and get them to buy in on it. I think it's important that instead it's like, it's trying to forge a collaborative relationship. It's like, you have a bunch of players. If you have I played a lot of soccer, and you'd have a superstar sort of player on a team who was just like a ball hog, kept the ball the long, and eventually everyone would swarm around them. And they're great, but not if they're not working within the unit. And so I think that's it. One of the things is like, I may have had a great idea. I may be able to produce really good results, but I'm not looking for you to buy those results and think I'm great. I'm looking for you to be, actually, this, you might be a valuable member of this team because you're solving this piece of the puzzle. And I found the corners, but there's a middle piece that's missing, and trying to approach it that way, where it's very like, not me speaking to you, me speaking with you, me sharing my areas of expertise, eliciting your areas of expertise, and finding where they start to connect, and when we can start filling those gaps, and then showing you results and not making your life harder, which I think is important.
It's extremely important. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things that I wrote down was, you know, when we put these programs in, you know, it can be very easy to write a program and be like, oh yeah, because we do it all the time. So it is easy to me, but I'm asking somebody who's never done this thing or has not done it correctly, because otherwise we wouldn't be here, to do the thing. And so, yeah, or like within your position, you're infiltrating their space. And I know that when I've had people come into my space, like I get very defensive and it's like, no. So yeah, being able to establish that relationship, you know, having, like I said, that forging that collaboration and finding, you know, the common ground really is, it's, you know, talking about motivation, talking about learning, you know, listening to what their experiences are and seeing again through that behavioral lens of like, ah, now, you know, they've highlighted on something that I know that I can touch a little bit more on, and not, you know, again, like you said, forcing them to accept it, like it has to be this way. It should be a collaborative process. The other thing that I think is really cool is, you know, when you were working with the patients and everything, and you're having this great feedback from them, I mean, to the point that, you know, they want to be competitive, they're asking for if they can use it in other situations and taking it home, which for me, that really is like what that, you know, for that's reinforcing, like, and not just from, yeah. But so looking at it from like a reinforcing side of it, you know, we thought the audible tone is kind of what's doing it. That signals the reinforcer. But when we actually break down like what is the crucial consequence, you know, what is that? What's actually maintaining it? And I wonder, because you had these conversations with them, if that knowledge helps kind of shift. I mean, are you tracking with me on this? Because I feel like I'm being a little fluffy, but like we're moving it away from, you know, you're not reliant on, you were all reliant on the audio tone to know if you're doing a certain thing and measuring it that way. But at the same time, what actually maintains that behavior in the long run, that part of the critical consequence is the knowledge that, hey, look, I can move better. I can walk with my grandkids or my children or the dog or play sports or whatever it is. So how was that conversation with the patients? Because so again, we've had these kind of layers. So we speak up here and then we start collaborating and we're still kind of using multiple jargons and on a professional level, but now we're speaking to, you know, average everyday person who doesn't go and read about orthopedic surgery. You know, most people, I mean, I like to read about what's going to happen to me first, but some people don't. And it's kind of like, I trust the doctor. It's cool. So having a conversation with them on a very scientific and, you know, very nerdy topic, you know, what was that process like? And was it something too, I guess, and also as a follow-up with that is, was it something you guys did as like a team, or was it just like you and the patient talking, or was it like you and the PT? Sorry, I threw a lot of questions.
Yeah, I think you did. But I think you said a lot of really good things. So I want to touch on a couple of things based off of all of that. I think one of them, right, especially your comment with the team and things like that, and not wanting to increase like effort and things like that, from the physical therapist side of things, is that we were, one of the things we were reminded me of a story, and I love stories, but like we're really, really purposeful about with all of this process was that unit. And so like before I did anything, like there's multiple times where like, we set up meetings with the physical therapists were there, the orthopedic surgeon was there, the clinical director was there, I was there, and we would have the conversations. I remember one of the first ones, this is the very beginning. I didn't know what I didn't know then. Oh my goodness. Now that I look back, but I built this incredibly beautiful like portfolio with like different graphs and images. It looks at the attack, how much the faster the muscle starts to turn on, how fast it goes down. I was like, and I can get this to you guys and I can give this to you all of the time. Like, no worries. And then they're like, that's so cool. It's like, isn't it? Would you guys like me to like send this to you and like make you data sheets and like provide you this information? It's like, no. I was like, disconnect, like wires are not firing. What? You thought it was cool, but you don't want it. I remember like Manish and I both left a little bit disheartened at that moment. It's like, what do you mean? Like, I can give you all this information about your patient and how well they're doing. But what we realized, like, well, it's not, they're not that. It's like, you're giving me all this information that now I have to look through and scan through and read. And I already have a very busy job with lots of demands and you're asking me to do more. And so I think it was leaving and realizing that. And I was like, okay, everything we design here, the data should be simple. The input and output should be given to the patient. We can give updates to the physical therapist, but we can't increase any of their burden. But I definitely left, both Manish and myself did, is like thinking, what the heck? I told you I can like give you so much and you don't want it. And then eventually realized, wow, how arrogant of me to be like that, where I'm going into your place and your job and I'm saying, here's all this extra stuff. And now I'm judging you for saying, no, I have too much on my plate. I can't do that. And that kind of like was a flip that like, so all the programming and how we arranged everything, the interactions with the physical therapist was a big driving factor. Then the other question you had, Ahmed, you had was like with the patients. And those conversations, all of the informed consents that we, and everything like that, I'd walked the orthopedic surgeon through that and the clinical director through all of that. Because one thing I always wanted to do was you guys are the ones who are going to recruit, not me. Because I don't know if there's something else that should be considered on the medical side of things, whether this person is a good pick, like, would it be running into an issue here? What are some considerations? I want you as the expert to determine, like, is it reasonable for us to have them in the research study? Or is there other complications we should be aware of? So we gave that packet to them. I also gave a brief form packet to them, where they would talk about the study and the patients would then sign up. And then when they came into the clinic is when I would first interact with them, like that session one. And I would then explain the whole process. And I wasn't sciencey. I always said, hey, if you're interested in the science, and a couple of people were, great. I can geek on that. We can talk about it and more about the muscles firing and how we're going to teach you how to engage those muscles again and how this works. But otherwise, I dropped it way down. I was like, this here, we're going to put this on your leg. And what that's going to do is it's going to tell us if the muscle's working. And what we want is the muscle to work harder and better over time, because right now it's weak and we don't want that. So this is going to tell us if we're actually working harder and harder. And then I would pull up the app and I would put the flex, the SCMG on myself, and I would like squeeze my muscle and I was like, oh, this is working really hard. And then I would do a lighter squeeze and say, oh, it's not. And so I said, what we're going to do is we're going to use this on your knee. And when you flex your knee during this exercise, we're going to set a goal, and that goal is going to be based off of where you are today. And if you meet your goal, you're going to get a ding. If you really, really meet your goal, you're going to fill that bar all the way up. That's what you want to do. And we're just going to keep working. But you're always the one in charge of that goal. And the goal is to fill it up as many times as you can and to make it ding as often as you can. And that's the first, that's how like a base conversation had. And like, I was like, this is going to make that muscle stronger. And then when they asked if they had questions and they wanted to talk more about the contingencies and the feedback, or oftentimes why is this like, is it motivating and things like that? Then we would unpack that more. But I started simple. I gave them the information they needed. And I didn't want to provide too much because especially early on, they're in a lot of pain. They just had surgery. This is like right after surgery that they're coming in, like sometimes 3 days after. They're really brand new. We're working with them. And the last thing they need is me to be piling on information that isn't pertinent to them in the moment. And may be difficult to understand, especially if you're in pain and there's that response competition for you. And so it was really like piecing together things. And as later on, we'd have more conversations about it. I would be like, hey, you were here like a week ago. Now you're here. And you see how that's changed. I would give them that like after we started going with things, because I want to be very cognizant of the fact that they're in pain and physical therapy is not fun during those early stages, especially. And so when you're in that situation, some people like want all that info, but a lot of us is just like, tell me what I need to do and let me get done with it because this sucks. And if I'm in an aversive stimulus, I want to escape that aversive stimulus as fast as I can. So I want to be very cognizant of, aware of that.
Again, we go back to seeing how that reinforcer shifts and where we can start to remove ourselves because it's no longer, quote unquote, under our control. I don't have to give you the Skittle or the sticker or the beep or whatever. You're fully in control of that, which, yeah, is beautiful. You become your own contingency analyst. I know how to make the yes. beep happen.
That's really what it was. It's getting them. They were in control of the contingencies. And showing them how to do that and then getting them involved so that I should be an irrelevant piece of the puzzle.
Oh, that's super rad. So one of kind of the last things, I think this is a good time because we're, you know, looking at time and I want to be mindful because it is Friday and everyone should have an excellent Friday. I'm super stoked right now. Like I'm going to have to go take a walk and be like, this was so exciting. Yeah. So thanks for nerding out with us, guys. But one of the objectives that we had was discussing when you're applying your scope and staying within your competency and ethical practices and everything. And this is something I've seen kind of pop up across the different social medias and everything. Even as recently as like, I think I saw a Reddit post maybe this morning or yesterday that was asking about what are other things that I can do with this science? Like people are feeling burned out or, hopefully they are seeing that the science can be applied to a variety of things. Again, you know, it's whatever, you know, if we can measure it, we can observe it, play bien. Like we can play with it, man. So what are some of the recommendations maybe that you have for people that are looking to kind of broaden their competencies and everything, but still maintain and still play, you know, and stay within our scope?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. A fun one to kind of end on and wrap things up off. And I'll try not to go too long-winded because I can geek out on this part for like, I'd be here for 5 hours. But I think that the first thing I always suggest, particularly to new behavior analysts and stuff like that, or master's students, is to go reread some of early Skinner papers. Go reread Skinner 35, go reread 31, Skinner 45, my absolute favorite paper. And think about what's actually being said in that. Because that's where our philosophical foundation comes from. And that's what's telling us about like how broadly applicable our science actually is. And for people who are like, what could I do with it? I think like read it and realize when Skinner talks about a flexible unit, it's a very purposeful definition defining flexible unit, right? Even though it kind of puts us in a weird place as a science, what do you mean? Are units flexible? It changes. And as a science, that's weird. But also it's because of that choice and building a foundation of that science on that allows us then to say, well, I'm going to make the unit like this tiny right now, and I'm going to make it really, really big. And I'm going to find where I found the contingencies. And that's where I'm going to go. And so if you can find a contingency and you can show up and control, well, now that's an area you can play in. So if you think about something and you're like, I wonder if there's operant behavior going on there. Okay. You can play there now. You as a behavior analyst can begin to move into that domain. And now I think if we move from like, okay, I could do it, I can find it, I see how much I could do with it. Now, how do you do that while maintaining within your scope of competency? Because just because there's an operant there doesn't mean you can necessarily play with that operant within your own scope of competency. I think that's what we always have to be really, really mindful of. Like when I started this work, I started off with just putting it on myself and finding operants. I mean, like, can I train a muscle? Oh, and learning how I train small amplitude muscles. How do I arrange the contingencies? What's too much of a jump? How's too fast of a change? And then I worked with undergraduate students beforehand. And I went through a couple of studies and I worked with that and I worked with different muscle groups so that I started to become an expert on arranging contingencies for small changes in muscle movement. Because it's different to arrange that than it is to arrange contingencies for a pigeon pecking a key, than it is to remain contingencies to increase manding behavior, and than it is to arrange contingencies for aggression in dogs. Like, these are all different ways of arranging it, but still contingencies. It's still environmental manipulation. It's still analyzing that stuff, but you want to be aware of what exactly you're stepping into. And I think that the most important thing when doing this, especially if you're breaking new ground, is like I think I've probably said this now to an excessive amount, is like, have a team, work with those who have their expertise in the particular areas. I worked with orthopedic surgeons and physical therapists, clinical director. I got the patients involved and I read a lot. But these are things like you should do. So like, if you're going to jump into a new area, do it, be excited, get jam on the fact that we have a science that's like loose and flexible. But be aware that because there's an operant doesn't mean that you know everything else surrounding that operant. So identify the aspects that you don't know and then bring in experts, find people who are willing to play with you on those and get them involved so that you can build in your own expertise with their expertise and you can begin to complement each other.
Alrighty, here's the second of your two key words. Second word is unit, UNIT. A behavioral unit can be as small as a muscle flex. Unit. You know, think about the whole, what we're playing. And I love the fact that you use that same kind of lingo because that's how I feel. It's one of those, this is exciting. It's fun. I like being creative. You know, even if I'm just creating like a communication system for somebody, like there's a lot of fun things that we can do and we can pull in and we can teach. And so, yeah, exploring that creativity and then, you know, letting other people into our sandbox. And learning to share our toys, is important because we have some really cool technology. But there's also other really cool technology out there that, you know, is just waiting for a curious behavior analyst to go, haha, I see something over there. So yeah, I mean, this is, again, I always strongly encourage people to find a verbal community, you know, reach out to us. You know, the podcast, reach out to Brennan. You know, we've got all of our guests on our webpage, so you can, you know, check out their social medias and see what they're doing. And if we don't know, we probably know somebody who does, because there's a lot. I mean, I can play 6 degrees of behavior analysis with anybody. It's a little creepy sometimes. We have a very small world here, guys, but that's okay because I like being, you know, putting people in contact with other people. That way, information, it's so good. When you have the information, you can go and do better things with it. So always strongly encourage. So kind of with that, I'm going to let you say two things of one, any last thoughts? And then two, if you could actually provide your socials and your contact and everything, if people did want to reach out to you and find you on the interweb.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing is like, if anyone is ever interested in getting involved with health and behavior or playing with units at different sizes, feel free to reach out to me. Read Skinner 45, take it to heart. As applied behavior analyst, I think always keep in the back of yourself as you're going through and you're thinking about things, you're programming research, because we're research practitioners here. And if you're going to be a research practitioner, doing research is okay to do. It's important. You're a researcher. It's okay to do that. But also, if you're in the applied world and you're working with real people, remember that. And the checkpoint I have is I always ask myself, okay, quality of life. Is my research question related to that? if this goes well, will I be improving and increasing the degrees of freedom of this individual? Okay. And I just, and always circling that. It's like my Jiminy Cricket. But if you want to reach out to me and you want to geek out on this stuff, health, behavior of different sizes, different levels of analysis, theory and philosophy, you can find me on Facebook at Brennan. Just search Brennan Armshaw. There's not a lot of Brennan Armshaws in the world. Actually, I think I'm the only one. So if you Google me, you're going to find me. And my email is brennan.armshaw@mail.wvu.edu. I'm sure Kelly can post that with the something. If people want to reach out via email, you can also find me on LinkedIn, and everything's up to date on that as well.
I think I put the correct one in there, but yeah, again, it'll be on our site, and you know, that way you can always check things out, or again, check out, I'm sure you're probably on WVU's website now.
I'm on WVU's website. Yep. If you Google me, just Google Brennan Armshaw. The first like three Google pages are just me.
That's so awesome.
Just Google it. You'll find me. And I'm always, always happy to talk to y'all. Anybody.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for hanging out with us, guys. This was an excellent start to the weekend, and I'm super jazzed for all of your adventures. And I'm really excited at the prospect of this kind of technology, and fingers crossed, all of them, to see and, you know, revisit this in a couple of few years and see how things are continuing to progress.
Definitely.
Yeah, I feel like you said the quality of life and the application for, you know, just something like this is so powerful. Like, you know, again, my brain has been reeling this whole time of like, oh my gosh, like how amazing could this be if you could have someone take it home, put it in this situation anyway. So yeah, this is the joys of our science and why it's fun to get curious and get nerdy and just see and play and see how things go.
I completely agree. Thank you so much for having me on here to geek out and talk about this and share some of it, Kelly. I appreciate it.
Yay. You're very welcome. All right, guys. Thank you so much for hanging out. I love you all. Be kind humans. And yeah, go forth and make someone's day awesome or more awesome. And we'll talk to you later. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this adventure of the Atypical Behavior Analyst. Check out the website, atypicalba.com, for more episodes, references, and to purchase CEUs. To stay up to date, like and follow us on social media. Just search Atypical Behavior Analyst. If you like the show, please rate and leave us a review. And if you want to support the show but don't need CEUs, you can help by clicking the Buy Us a Coffee link in the show notes. So until next time, listeners, grab your towel, keep exploring, and we'll see you in the fringes.
You know you're a pretty rad human when you hang out after the talk just to hear a preview clip from the next episode. So, adjust your earbuds, and here's a preview from our next episode 48, Translating Psychiatric to Behavioral with Sue Gabriel. Enjoy, and we'll see you soon.
And so my job has, through the years, has literally been to look for zebras. You know, they say, you know, almost everything is always a horse. No, a lot of times there are zebras. And that was my job. And it was to sort out what was something physical going on, what was something environmental going on, what might be something within the family structure, what might side effect to a medication. And then if there's still stuff left over, taking a look at, is it something psychiatric?